From Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training centers in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska. This is Dog Works Radio, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. Dog Works Radio is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It is August 10th, 2011, and this is Robert Forto hosting from Willow, Alaska, the mushing capital of the world. Our co-host today is busy doing a send-home for our Camp Works program in Denver. She's hoping to call in just a little while, and we'll bring her up when she does. But today we have two ladies calling in from Oregon, my old college stomping ground, so I'm very familiar with where these ladies are working and handling their dogs. They work with search and rescue groups in the kind of the outlying counties of Oregon. So I'm going to bring them up without further ado. We have Amy Hisaoka. Again, I apologize if I messed that up. And Monica McFadden. Amy works with Lane County in Eugene, Oregon, home of the Ducks of the University of Oregon down there, and Monica works for Josephine County Sheriff's Office, the search and rescue group there. Monica, let's talk to you first. Where is Josephine County?
Josephine County is the center of Josephine County is Grants Pass, Oregon, and it is the major place where the wild and scenic portion of the Rogue River takes off. So we are the section of Oregon that is sort of, we're one county removed from the coast. For any of your listeners who remember the Kim family search in 2006, that is the county that the Kims were ultimately located in.
Gotcha. And you've been working in search and rescue since 2005 with your current dog, Mara. She is a golden retriever, and you guys work with human remains detection. I want to really get into that today. And you're training a brand new little puppy, Dingle, another golden retriever who's starting his search and rescue training. And you've worked all over the area, including California, Oregon, the whole Pacific Northwest there. First off, what else have I missed about you and what you're all about?
Well, the other discipline that we do with Mara is what's called air scent training, and air scent are the dogs who we release into primarily wilderness areas, although we're increasingly doing urban work for missing Alzheimer's patients and things of that sort. And these dogs are not trained to find a specific person. They are trained to find anyone who is out there. And so Mara also does air scent work, which is the more traditional search and rescue. The human remains detection is a sort of a subset of that.
Gotcha. And let's bring Amy up. Amy Hisaoka is a handler with Lane County in Oregon, like I said, right near Eugene. And she's been an obedience instructor since 2003. And as her bio says, she's been working with dogs her whole life. You know, I think that's everybody that's ever called into the show has worked with their dogs their entire life. It's kind of a passion of all of us. And she has been a show handler, ran dogs in agility, obedience trials, and Schutzhund. And she's going into work with search and rescue with her dog. I believe it's Maylee Von Bonnock.
Well, close.
Go ahead.
It's Maylee Von Bonnock.
There you go. And I assume that is a German Shepherd, correct?
Yes.
All right. So tell us about what you're doing and what you're all about.
Well, Maylee is a year and a half now, and so both Maylee and myself are fairly new to search and rescue. This is going on my second year now. And so we kind of started together. We had to go through training and certification and all that. And so we are enjoying it very much, and we enjoy going to the trainings. And Maylee, the dog, she is doing very well. She does a discipline. Her main discipline is called trailing, where they go after a specific person rather than air scent, where they find any human scent. Maylee goes after a specific scent. So that's useful for, like, if a child gets lost in a park, and there's millions of people there, but you only want to find that one child, you use a scent article like the child's jacket or something, and she gets a scent off of that and only follows that trail. So she's doing very well in that, and she's been training pretty much since she was 8 weeks old. And she was also imprinted on cadaver, we call it, at 3 weeks old, where the puppies are really young and they let them play with toys that have the cadaver scent, which is kind of gross, but that's how they imprint them. And so when they're older and start training, they kind of remember that, and they don't shy away from that scent as they start their training.
And before we get too deep into this search and rescue work and with the work with cadaver dogs, I know you contacted me through our connection on LinkedIn. And with that, you have an equipment company. So let's talk about that just for a second. I want to make sure we can promote that a little bit here on the show.
Sure. When I started training Miley for search and rescue, I found that dog gear was really expensive. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And I was kind of, you know, I'm kind of crafty and like to do sewing and stuff. So I started making her own gear just with my sewing machine, and I started picking up leather craft. And so I started making her own stuff, and then people saw it when I, you know, took it to seminars and trainings, and they say, oh, that's really cool. Where did you get that? And I said, oh, I made it, you know. And so people started wanting it, so I kind of put a few items online and made a website. And so it's, you know, picked up from there. And Monica was one of my, you know, first customers. That she bought the first search collar that I made just for Mara. And so that was kind of a cool deal. And but
absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun little, it's not, you know, huge right now, but I just do it more because I enjoy making things, and so I can customize each harness or each dog vest per customer, and it's really fulfilling to me.
And what is the website, Amy, for your company?
It's www.mountaindoggear.com.
And, you know, I'm sure both of you ladies can attest that you have to have customized gear for this type
Absolutely.
Of work. As a musher, we're always looking for the newest and best way mm-hmm. to cut a few pounds, ounces, I guess, to make a life a little bit easier. I know with your guys' work, you want to make sure that your equipment is not only very heavy duty and able to withstand the rigors of your work, but also has to be customized for the work that you're doing. You just can't use a regular old, you know, leash that you buy at Target. It has to be something that's going to withstand the elements. So today we're talking to two search and rescue handlers in the Oregon area. And I also have Michelle on the line. She has finished with her Camp Works program send home. Michelle, are you there?
I am.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us. We're just getting started here with Monica and Amy. Monica, let's talk a little bit about Mara. She's been doing this for a while. I'm sure that you've been involved with this quite a long time. My first question to you, and the way that we're going to handle this is we're just going to bounce back and forth between you two ladies, and so our listeners don't get confused. When one of you guys are speaking, if we're going, you know, back and forth, just say this is Monica or this is Amy, and that way everybody knows what we're on task with. So my first question to you, Monica, is: are you a sheriff's officer or are you a volunteer that works for the sheriff's office?
I am a volunteer. This is Monica, and I am a volunteer that works for the sheriff's department in Oregon. The search and rescue function is by law left with the sheriff's departments. Each county sheriff is the person responsible for search and rescue in his or her county. Most of the counties, and I think it's true in Lane as well, what they do is they form a volunteer group that then becomes their boots on the ground, their resources. And so in our county, we are part of the sheriff's department, but we are not sworn deputies. We are simply volunteers.
Right. Do you guys have, this is for both of you ladies, do you guys have a formal type of training? Did you guys go to some school? Is this something that's taught by the group itself? Where did both of you guys, I don't know if a certification or whatever, but where did you guys become handlers?
Well, this is Monica. Let me start because probably I'm a little further along than Amy, and I think that I think though Amy's may be fairly similar. In our county, what you do first is that you first become a trained searcher. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association actually has a certification program that every searcher in Oregon has gone through. Which is a whole series of navigation issues and knots issues and over being able to prepare to save yourself overnight, all of that sort of basic search tactic stuff. Once you get that in our county, you can start into one of the specialty units. K-9 is a specialty unit. We train with our unit. There's seven dogs in the unit at the moment. There are three of us that are certified. And what we do is that we begin to help people move their dog from mainly pet status to becoming a full-fledged search dog. So we train in our county twice a week. And as we go along, we have sort of benchmarks that we check off to make sure that people are progressing, that their dog is able to go out and search, their dog is able to come back and tell them about having found a person, they can navigate a search area. Ultimately, we end up with two certification tests. One is a 60-acre certification test for the air scent dogs that gets them functional. They have to go out and find one person in an area they have no idea where the person is in 2 hours. Then there's a more advanced state test, which is 160 acres, one person in 4 hours. And once you get that certification, you are now certified to go into other counties as well. Human remains detection follows a similar pattern and is generally not started until the dog has certified in a basic discipline. So that's
gotcha.
How we do it. And Amy, what about Lane?
Yeah, this is Amy. Yeah, it's very similar. We also go by the OSSA standard for dog certification. So there's two certifications we have to get, one for the human and one for the dog. And in our county, we take a class put on by our sheriff's office, and it lasts 3 months, and that's the human certification. And like Monica's training, it goes over navigation, map and compass, that kind of stuff, and first aid. We also get first aid certified in the class. And we also have a field test at the very end where we have to build a shelter and spend the night in the woods. And so it kind of prepares us for what might be out there in a real search. And the dog's test is basically what Monica was talking about. You know, they have to find a subject in so many hours. And so Miley has not yet been certified by the OSSA, but she's working up towards that.
You know, guys, we have a lot of contact with people calling us up and saying that they want to have their dog trained for search and rescue work. We just got a call. I think it was just the other day. Somebody had sent an inquiry, just you know, on a basic training.
Robert,
yes,
Robert. Yeah, let me talk about that for a little while, because I want to first and foremost say thank you, ladies, for coming on and really articulately explaining what search and rescue is. Because Robert and I we get a lot of calls and inquiries from people that say, my dog wants to do search and rescue, and I bring them in not to sign them up. I bring them in to sit them down and explain to them that, you know, this is what it involves. It is a detailed, instructive procedure that you need to teach your dog, and a four-year-old dog's not going to do search and rescue, you know, and it's disheartening because we have the same type of people that will call and say, my dog's going to do agility and you're going to be the trainer, or my dog's going to do this and you're going to be the trainer. And I'm so glad that we're doing this show today, because it really is going to enlighten people as to the devotion and the commitment that it takes to do some of these types of working jobs. I mean, this is a working job for the dog, and it's a volunteering commitment to the human. But at the same time, there is a lot of things involved with this type of training, And, you know, that's what I'm hoping that we can get across to people is, you know, it's a beautiful thing to do with your dog, but it's not for every person. It's not for every dog. And, you know, you might go through years and years of training and you're having a good time and you guys are learning how to do the campouts. I call it scouting for dogs. You know, you're virtually in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts with your dog, and it's way cool. You know, Amy just said I have to build a shelter and learn how to survive and things. That is really cool. But you might not ever be called up. And thank
right.
God you might not ever be called up
right.
because you might not ever be needed. And so that's kind of what I want to touch on. And thank you guys for letting me chime in late and say my piece. But basically, I'm glad you guys are out there to help me explain to people that it's not for everybody and it's not for every dog and it's a lot of commitment.
Hold on just a second, Monica. If I could just add one more point to that before we go forward, and I hope you can address this as well. I think a lot of people that are interested in this think that they can just become certified on their own and then, you know, kind of just be called up on, you know, some miraculous phone list. You know, they have their dog and, you know, they're certified to do this. You know, they don't have a clear-cut understanding of what it means that you do have to work with the sheriff's office in Oregon's case or in most municipalities. It's some type of large group that you guys are working with. It's just not, you know, like a volunteer firefighter that, you know, that carries around stuff in the back of their car. They're part of a very tight-knit group, correct?
Correct,
yeah.
Robert. And I guess one thing I want to mention, Michelle, we get those same phone calls routinely, Amy, don't we, where people
yes.
call up and say, I've got this wonderful dog, and will you train this dog to be a search and rescue dog? One thing about the search and rescue dog is that it's not just the dog. It is a dog and a handler team. The dog is only able to communicate to us information if the handler can translate that into English so that our incident commanders are searching, or the people who are running the search can understand what the dog is telling us so the handler can understand what the dog is telling us. So it is never a case that somebody's dog gets trained for search and rescue and handled by somebody else. It's a dog and handler team that goes together. And as a very good friend of both Amy's and my mentions, Kim Kelly, who was another dog handler around in California, we regard ourselves as we may be volunteers, but we're professionals. And
right.
we recognize that because every time we go out, someone's life is on the line. And this is not, you know, I mean, I love agility people, but, you know, if something fails in agility, you don't get a cue. If something fails in search and rescue, somebody dies. And so, you know, it's one thing that we stress with people who talk to us is you're making a commitment that you and your dog will be ready to go out and do the same sort of work that firefighters do or police officers do. You're just going to do it with your dog in a volunteer situation. And as you mentioned, Robert, in most cases, Oregon has its own system. Every state has its own system. But there's not many places where you, as an individual, could get called. There are some private search and rescue canine groups, but they have spent years developing relationships with law enforcement, with the fire departments, with whomever is in charge of search and rescue in their area. So, yeah, it's a huge commitment.
If you guys could answer, my next question is, when a lot of people think about search and rescue work, they only think about search and rescue dogs. They don't think about all of the other support
that's going on.
For example, in Colorado, they have a huge unit up in the mountains, you know, one of those high altitude rescues, and they don't use too many dogs, but they use a lot of mountaineering skills. Can you tell us about some of the other disciplines involved in search and rescue besides working with dogs?
Amy, this is Monica. Do you want to talk a little bit about Eugene Mountain Rescue, which is one of the premier mountain rescue groups in Oregon?
Yeah, Eugene Mountain Rescue is a great group. We sometimes train with them and on call out. Sometimes they call out, you know, with us, depending on the situation. But in each search and rescue group, there's different venues. So usually there's like the special vehicles unit, there's the mountain rescue, there's the canines, there's the ground searchers. Or ground pounders, they call them. But there's a lot of different areas in search and rescue. And so you have to certify as a whole, and then you also sometimes have to certify in your individual group. So the mountain rescue guys, they have to do more stuff with ropes and climbing, and they have different equipment than we do. They have, of course, climbing equipment. They have to get, you know, certified mountain, whatever their certification might be. But, yeah, it's a little different training than us, and we do come together together on general things, but they have their own specific training for their needs.
And, Robert, gotcha. If I could add in, like, Amy, I'm not sure how many specialty units there are in Lane County. Josephine County has, for example, an ATV unit, which are the people who specialize in using ATVs to go out and search for people along trail systems, along mm-hmm. ATV trails. We have a mounted unit that goes out on horseback because there are times the horses can get to someplace that no one else can get to.
Right.
We have a mountain unit, much like Eugene, because we have a lot of hills and mountains around here. There's a snow unit. Because in the winter, of course, we have a lot of snow in Oregon, and so specialized equipment is necessary for that. We also have a communications unit that are the people who keep us on radio and keep us safe when we're out there. We have a dive unit that goes out and does mainly recoveries, unfortunately, but is able to go into water situations and recover people. And then we have an overhead team who are the people who are actually running the searches. The canine teams will often work with those different groups. For example, we are now, in Josephine, we're working with our dive team to see if we can have the dogs help the divers locate where people are. Just one of the things we just did with Dingle, the puppy, is we actually have started to introduce him to the mounted horses, and we're thinking about actually training him so that he could actually be carried on the back of a horse if we either had to insert him or move him from an area. Not something most adult dogs are willing to do, but a puppy doesn't know any better. So if we start him when he's 10 weeks old, by the time he's 2, he'll think nothing of getting on the back of a horse. So it is a huge thing, and every area of the country has slightly different specialized units because of where they are. Some units, for example, have an air unit where they actually have volunteer helicopter pilots.
Hmm. What is, for either one of you ladies, what is the response time? You know, you find out that, little Johnny's missing in the woods somewhere. He kind of ran off from the backyard. After that call comes into 911, what is the typical time that it takes, a group in any municipality, I guess yours included, to get things rolling and to be out there searching for Johnny?
Amy, what's the time in Lane?
Well, in Lane, it really depends on the situation, but for instance, if it's like an urgent situation, like a child wanders away from a campsite and it's dark, first we have what they call the hasty team go out. They are guys and gals that can go out on a moment's notice. They drop whatever they're doing. If they're at work, their work understands that if they need to go, they let them go. And so they can be there within, 15, 20 minutes because that child, could be in danger. Now, if it's an adult, a healthy adult that's been hiking and it's been a couple days since, someone's heard from them, then they do more. They start with the ground searchers, the GSAR unit, which includes dogs. And so it really depends on each individual situation. And that's how our search and rescue coordinator usually calls the shots on who needs to go out first, if dogs are needed or not, and they go from there.
Monica, what is your experience with that in terms of response time?
Pretty much the same. I mean, the thing is it really does depend upon the county. I know in Josephine County, for example, the dogs are often one of the very first units called out simply because we have a sheriff who really believes in using the dogs. And so what will happen is we'll get a phone call. And by the way, for your listeners, just so they understand the commitment that is being made, that phone call can come in any time in the 24 hours. The phone often rings at 3 o'clock in the morning. You've just gotten to sleep. The phone rings and it's somebody who needs help. So this is a 24/7 job. volunteer, professional, though it may be, it's still a job. Anyway, so what we find is it does depend. As Amy says, there are certain categories of people who are more critical: the children, the Alzheimer's patients, the person who's out hiking who doesn't know anything about the wilderness, or who is for some reason fragile. We may have a diabetic, we may have someone with heart disease. So the response is pretty much the same no matter what, but what's going to vary is how quickly they push the button to basically get people started, and then the time to respond. In some of our counties, for example, we have some of the wilderness areas, the national forests. It can take us 2 hours just to get to a search location. Sometimes we can be there in minutes, but the thing is, normally search and rescue is on the scene, I'd say, within 2 hours of receiving a phone call at the latest.
We're talking to two search and rescue handlers in the Eugene and Josephine County area of Oregon. And my next question to you guys, and I have a bunch of questions, so I might bounce around just a little bit, but the next one is, up here in Alaska, of course, we're a little bit different than everywhere else in terms of everything up here. Just recently, we had a musher that pretty much just walked off the face of the earth for a couple of weeks, and it seems that she didn't want to be found. You know, it's one of those things, and you know, they were wondering if it was a mental thing or whatever. But anyway, she just kind of walked off, and she was gone for, I think it was about 10 days or so. And they had all the searchers out there and, you know, looking for her. And up here, it's the majority of the troopers are doing it. Most of them are, paid police officers, the Alaska State Troopers. We didn't have a lot of volunteer guys up here. How do you guys respond to something like that if a person doesn't want to be found and they could possibly be hiding, and they've got all of these people out searching for them and things like that? Can you enlighten us a little bit on that?
You know, this is Monica. I remember that search, and our hearts went out to the people up in Alaska who were searching, because we know you've got your troopers. You also, by the way, have some of the best canine units in the country. You've got some great people out of Anchorage and Fairbanks and some other places that I know about who are good buddies that we see from time to time. You know, the thing is, if a person doesn't want to be found, a person doesn't want to be found. It's frustrating if they are consciously using resources that are very expensive to operate. I mean, even though we're volunteers, for example, our county keeps a record every year, and last year determined that we saved the county close to $600,000 in manpower hours alone, not to count all the equipment and things that we volunteer. So that's a frustrating thing, but the thing is, that's sort of the outlier person. Most people who are out there do want to be found. Matter of fact, they're desperate to be found, and so I guess I look at that kind of person and I see, gee, that's really unfortunate. Now, the thing that worried me about that particular situation is there was some indication that there may have been some mental distress, whether illness or whether just stress. And, you know, sometimes we have people in that situation. Those people are incredibly vulnerable, and sometimes they believe they don't want to be found. We're still going to look for them. I mean, you know, if not only for them, but for their families.
Right.
So I guess my perspective on that is we're going to look for somebody unless we're told that the person has asked us to stop.
Mm-hmm. And with that, my next point to – pretty much on the same thing about maybe not wanting to be found, or they don't tell somebody. And what the scenario I think of is like that movie, the real life movie of the guy in Utah. It was called 127 Hours was the name of the movie. And he kind of went out, and this doesn't really have anything to do with dogs, I don't think, but it's kind of just search and rescue in general. You know, he went out and he didn't tell anybody. And you know, if you're a single guy and you're going to wake up one morning on a weekend morning and you're going to go hiking, you know, people might not know anything until you don't show up to work on Monday. How difficult is that as a search and rescue group to deal with things on that level?
Well,
Monica,
go ahead, Amy.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, it is harder for the dogs after a few days because there's no trail, especially for the trailing dogs, because that's my dog's discipline. Because there's no, you know, after 24 hours, it gets very difficult to follow a trail. And so if the guy's been out there for, you know, a weekend, That's when they go with the air scent dogs. They do a lot of searching, but it's hard if he doesn't tell anybody, because then it's hard to know where to start. So we always encourage people to always tell somebody where you go, you know, bring the right equipment, you know, a GPS, a compass, whatever. But it's always a good idea to tell somebody, because if you do get lost, we don't know where to even start. And there's a lot of research that goes on when somebody like that gets lost, that the sheriffs have to call the family members. Where might he go? What are his habits? Where is his favorite? Does he hunt? Does he, you know, what are his favorite places to go? And so there's a lot of research involved, but a lot of times those people, if we don't know where to start, it takes a lot longer to find them if we ever do.
Right. Robert, this is Monica. A perfect example of that was the Kim family. The Kim family stayed lost for as long as they did because all that was known was that they were somewhere between Seattle and San Francisco. That's an impossible search area. Even when it was determined that they may have taken a particular turnoff, the search area was still over 2,000 acres. So, you know, the thing is, we encourage people, as Amy said, we go into the schools and do a program with the children where we try to start it from very young. But we say to people, always let somebody know where you're going. Always have a buddy system where there's, you know, if you're going to be out, that if you haven't called back by a certain time, they start making phone calls. You know, we encourage people to put something on the dashboard of their car if they're going out hiking, which has the hike information. Here's where I was going. Here's when I left. Here's what I'm wearing. Here's who's with me. Because in search and rescue, time is the critical factor.
Right.
Especially in your area, Alaska, even more so. But down here in the winter, if somebody's out overnight, the likelihood that we're going to find them alive is not very high because of hypothermia.
Right. My next question to you ladies is, how has social media helped out in terms of search and rescue work? I know for years we've had Amber Alerts and things like that, but now, and again, I'm going back to the recent search of the lady up here, but it's very common, especially on Facebook, where people will become lost and they will start these search pages. And my question or my comment is what about these guys that are involved with posting these things, and then they go out and they start searching themselves? So I guess it's more of a two-pronged question. Is, you know, they're involved on social media. Hey, Missy's gone. You know, we need to you know, get the ball rolling. And then number two is, you have a group of people that are not trained, and they're out searching for people in areas that may or may not they may or not be familiar with. Can you guys explain that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, Lord knows we see that. You know, I think there's some positives and negatives to what's going on with the social media. There actually have been some recent stories in search and rescue realm where the social media has actually helped people be found. There's a story out of, I believe it was, Amy, do you remember the one out of, it was either Connecticut or Rhode Island, where a woman was out on a bike race. She fell. She'd broken something and couldn't get up. She had her cell phone with her, was able to text a friend on Facebook, told them where she was, and the unit was able to get there. The same thing is true now of cell phones. Where there is cell phone coverage, we are often getting text messages, phone messages from people in the woods that make it a little bit easier to find us. So there's some positives about that. The self-volunteering problem, you know, we love volunteers. Volunteers have sometimes found people because we've needed the extra help. The problem is, as you say, Robert, is we need for people to be sure that they are physically capable of going into the areas that we're going into. We've had people show up to try to volunteer on searches in the Calmeopsis out here in flip-flops and shorts. We're not sending them out in flip-flops and shorts. We wouldn't dream of that. So, you know, one of the things is we often tell people a lot of times you can help in other ways. For example, when we were up in Portland working on the search for Kyron Horman, which is still an ongoing search, the community came out in droves to feed us, to house us, to make sure we had clean laundry, to do everything to help the search and rescue people. And a lot of times that's the best way people can help. And Amy, you've had it happen, I know, up in Lane.
Yeah, when we get a lot of you know, helpers or volunteers that want to help out. And they all have good intentions, you know. It might be their family members that's missing. But the thing that we worry about is if they go out and search, they might get lost themselves or get injured, and then we'll have a bigger problem on our hands. And so we try to make them helpful, like Monica said, in other ways, maybe at base camp, you know, maybe providing food for the volunteers, the search and rescue volunteers. But we try not to put them in harm's way, because then that will make a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. But we know they want to, you know, their hearts are good and they want to help, so we try to include them in a safe manner.
That's a great point there about helping out on kind of on the fringes. And that's a great point that Monica brought up. You know, if you guys are doing multiple day searches, you might need, you know, a clean T-shirt or a clean pair of pants if you're out there in the wilderness or whatever. And if somebody can volunteer to do that laundry or provide that well-needed bottle of Gatorade or sandwich or whatever, that is the important part. My next question is, a lot of people think that search and rescue kind of falls into two realms, and it's driven by movies and the media. Of course, when 9/11 happened, everybody, you know, saw the dogs working and the jobs that they did. And then often you'll hear about the escaped prisoners, you know, that are escaping from prison. Do you guys work, number one, with the prisons or the Department of Corrections as a group of searchers? And my second part of that is, can you tell us a little bit about something as big as 9/11 and dogs working in that environment?
Robert, this is Monica. We do not do criminal work, and that, I think, is fairly standard throughout search and rescue. The the departments that we work for will not put us in harm's way. We are volunteers. We are not professional police officers. We do not carry guns. I believe that's fairly standard across most places. We may be asked to assist with criminal investigations in things like, for example, going out and doing an evidence search to try to find something that the department is looking for, but they're going to have made sure that we're safe before we do that. We are never used to find escaped prisoners or anything of that sort because it's too dangerous.
Right.
And they won't do that to us. That's what the people who carry the guns get to do. You know, in terms of that sort of stuff, we're more on the missing hiker, the missing Alzheimer's patient, the kid who's walked away from a playground, that sort of thing. 9/11 was, of course, the most dramatic thing that will hopefully ever happen in this country, and the work that the dogs did there was absolutely amazing. Dogs are used a lot in those kinds of disaster functions. Now, most of those dogs are actually yet another training level of dogs. They are the disaster dogs, and those dogs are trained because they have to be able to work on rubble piles, collapsed buildings, and things of that sort. Throughout the United States, the FEMA has actually task forces that are scattered around the country that are actually the ones that they call in those situations. Many of us, though, have also recognized that if there's a disaster in our area, we're going to be the first dogs in. And so we actually have tried to do some work in those areas so that our dogs would at least have an understanding as to how to work that. What the dogs can do in those situations, though, is the canine sense of smell is amazing. You know, it's an amazing tool, and the fact that they let us use it is quite wonderful. That's what we're using. We're using their ability to sniff out that there may be a person down in a rubble pile 300 feet that then can tell the firefighters where to go so that they don't have to spend quite as much time doing the searching.
Mm-hmm. And with that, how long can the dogs and the team, you know, we're focusing on the dogs because we're a dog show, but you made a great point, Monica, that is definitely an A plus B equals team in this, you know, with the handler. How long can you guys work? Is there a burnout period? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of people think that you guys are going to start on Monday morning and you're going to keep searching until either somebody's found or, you know, you just kind of fall over. What is the time frame for you guys?
Sometimes until we fall over, yes.
Yeah, sometimes.
This is Monica. I know that it depends upon a whole lot of factors. Let me sort of break that into two, and then, Amy, I'm going to have you talk about trailing, because trailing is a whole different thing, too. With the air scent dogs, our dogs out here, remember the type of terrain that we're working in the Pacific Northwest. It's a lot of pine trees. It's a lot of down stuff on the ground. Our dogs are normally capable of working anywhere between 4 to 6 hours with rest breaks during that period of time. Obviously, you know, we're going to sit down from time to time and take a little bit of a break. However, we've got some factors that come into that. Right now in the Pacific Northwest where I live, we're getting 100-degree temperatures. Our dogs are going to be done in about 30 minutes unless we give them a significant rest. So we have to take that into account. We have to do things like what Amy's been doing with her company where, you know, you put a cooling vest on the dog so that you can keep them going for a little bit longer. Depends upon the terrain. You know, we were just down at the coast on Sunday working. We were working in grass that was up to the handler's waist. So the dogs had to porpoise through that. That's very tiring for the dog. We were burning dogs out in about an hour. With cadaver work, human remains work, what I find at least, is that a dog's nose is only good in that work, which is very detailed work, for about 30 minutes before, again, they need a fairly substantial break. After a break, they can go back in. You know, but the other part of the, again, this is an A plus B team, is can the handler take the time? Not all jobs are understanding of people wandering off for 5 days. I think, though, in our mindset, we'll keep working until we find them. We'll keep working until we drop. And then, Amy, I know that the trailing dogs have a whole different sort of timing.
Right, yeah. It really depends on the situation again. The terrain is a huge factor. If it's just like an open field with short grass, we could go for, you know, a mile or more following
somebody. Do we have
somebody.
Those anywhere in Oregon?
Yeah. No, not really. But, you know, that would be like, you know, a dream search. But it's not like that. It's, you know, we're going through thick forests with blackberry bushes, with thorns and, you know, all these nasty bushes, and so it takes a while to weave through, and that's not only tiring for the dog but for the handler too, to climb over things, and you have to remember we're connected to the dog with a 30-foot line, and that gets tangled a lot, and so we're constantly untangling, you know, resetting up, okay, go on, go do your work, and you know, it's like it's a lot of hard work. So it really depends on the terrain, one, and also the heat, the temperature. The heat really gets to the dogs, and, you know, sometimes their cutoff is like half an hour, an hour, and then they have to rest. But if it's in the wintertime, of course, they could go a little longer because it's cool. And but it's the handler's job to always watch the dog and see what the dog, his condition is, and if the dog is too winded, it's the handler's job to say, okay, this dog is done. Then let the other ground searchers take over, you know. But a lot of times what the dog does is give the searchers a good direction of travel. So we know that the guy went this way. So that's a good start. And we trail him for about an hour or so or a couple hours, whatever it is. And then the ground searchers can take over and continue in that general direction. But it really cuts out a lot of work time as if there wasn't a dog at all.
Robert, let me just make one thing. Amy mentioned a lead. That only happens with the trailing dogs. The air scent dogs actually work off lead. So they're
right.
More like hunting dogs where they're actually ranging anywhere between 100 to 500 feet of us. So, yeah.
And that's a great point, because I think a lot of lay folks, they just think that all the dogs are on leashes, and that's not true there.
Yeah.
My point to that, guys, and then I know Michelle has a question or two, is you guys said that the dogs have, you know, a working span anywhere from a few hours to 30 minutes. How many dogs are we dealing with, or dog teams, are we dealing with on your typical search? Is it a group of 5, 10, 1, and then, you know, one and done? Or what are we dealing with on just your typical, you know, lost hiker type search?
Robert, this is Monica. It depends a lot on the county that frankly you get lost in. In our county, there are 3 dogs that will show up automatically. We have a trailing dog, actually 4 dogs, a trailing dog and 4 or 3 air scent dogs will show up. The trailing dog, as Amy has mentioned, will be used first to see if we can figure out which way did they go. And then the air scent dogs will be sent out from that point to basically say, let's cover this area and see if we can find them. A lot of places you're probably talking about anywhere between three to, I'd say maybe two to three dogs that will show up automatically. But most counties, most areas around the country have mutual aid arrangements, much like we do here in Oregon, with, for example, down where I am, the California-Oregon Regional Search and Rescue, where, again, after the KIM searches there now, I think there's eight counties that will respond when what we jokingly refer to as the big red button gets pushed. That can mean in our area that we can have as many as 15 to 20 dog teams in. And so a lot of it depends upon what the incident commander wants, what the people who are running the search want. Do they think they can use that many dogs? Amy, same in Lane, right?
Yeah, same here. And also what we do a lot of times is we join up with other counties. And because in Lane, we basically just have one certified dog, you know, our buddy Caroline. She has Joey. He's certified. So he goes on most of the searches. But if there's also, I think, Matt and Ruby now, they just, you know, they're doing stuff now. But we don't have very many actual certified dogs. And so what we do is we get together with other counties like Douglas or Marion, and we do combined searches. And so then we can use resources from both counties. And so it really depends. We might have just one dog, or we might have, you know, three or four. And like Monica said, they kind of, you know, piggyback off of each other. One dog does something, and then when that dog's done, then they send in the air scent dogs or cadaver dogs, whatever the situation might be.
Michelle, you have a question to ask?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're discussing two types of search and rescue dogs, trailing and air scenting. Are there any other types of search and rescue dogs on your team? I mean, I know of some Newfoundlands that will literally jump out of helicopters, dive into water, rescue swimmers, things like that. If you ladies can touch on a few of the other types of search and rescue other than these two types, which I know these two types are the most utilized, but there are other types.
Oh, absolutely, Michelle. This is Monica. There's dogs, again. You know, what we're capturing is the dog's ability to scent. And that means once we can do that, we can come up with lots of ways the dogs can help. As you mentioned, the Newfoundlands, in some areas, the Newfoundlands are actually used as water rescue dogs. They actually go into the water and save swimmers. Not so much here because our water just wouldn't pertain to that, but I know that they're used, for example, on the East Coast, and I believe some places in the West Coast. Up where you are in Alaska, many of your dogs are trained as avalanche dogs, which means that if a person is caught in an avalanche, you've got two situations there. If the dogs can get there fast enough, and that's a big challenge for the human part of the teams, often the dog can pinpoint the location of the avalanche victim before they succumb to asphyxiation. They can also be used for recovery in those situations. And so up in your area, those dogs are just enormous. We see that more in Oregon and Washington in the upper portions. We don't have as many avalanches down here. Plus, we don't get into that sort of mountainous terrain, although many of the ski areas down here have their own avalanche dogs.
Monica, just let me interrupt for a second. I mean, I'm actually in Denver, Colorado.
You are, okay.
I'm in Denver. So, you know, in our marriage agreement, it said we can live 3,000 miles apart.
Well, you know, actually in Colorado, though, you've got the same. We know that there are avalanche dogs working in your mountains.
We that's a primary use of search and rescue dogs here in Colorado is for our avalanche
absolutely.
Season. We actually have a season here called avalanche season.
You bet.
I think that we have more avalanches in the state of Colorado than any other mountain range in the entire United States, including Alaska.
Lord.
So it's pretty extreme. So that's why I'm glad that you touched on that.
Yep.
Because avalanches here are no joke. They are taken very seriously. The local REIs here really encourage people to come in and take their avalanche safety courses.
Absolutely.
Help to assist the dog in saving you.
Absolutely.
So you're actually teaching the quote-unquote victim, possible victim, and ways to how to assist the dog team and how to save you. So,
exactly.
You know, it's a very, very cool thing that, you know, you guys get to do being on these teams. But that's exactly what it is. It's a team effort.
Absolutely.
I'm really glad that both of you discussed ways that people can come and volunteer without their dogs. And feel like they're part of the rescue effort. You know, I know that when Hurricane Katrina happened, as well as Robert was involved with Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Hugo and all of those types of disasters, correct me if I'm wrong, but it is not recommended that you hop on a plane or get in your RV with your dog and show up and say, I'm ready to work.
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, even people like Amy and myself, we will not self-deploy to those situations, and the reason is because we get in the way. Our dogs, you know, are not yet disaster trained. I wouldn't even think about putting my dog into a Katrina-type situation. She's not ready for it. But I also would not expect those dogs to try to come up to our Oregon forest and automatically search here as well. So that's one thing that a professional search and rescue handler recognizes is, you know, your dog is not Wonder Dog. Your dog is good at certain things, and you put them to work in those certain things. But, you know, the other thing about those types of situations as well is that, you know, we were talking about there is Michelle, the disaster dog. There is the water search dog who actually helps dive teams figure out where drowning victims are located. You know, so that the dogs are used in a lot of different things. But, you know, we also want people to understand there's one other way you can help dog teams, or numerous ways. Obviously, money is always a nice thing because all of these dog teams are being run by volunteers. We're paying for our own equipment. We're housing these dogs, all their vet care and things like that. The other thing is we're always looking for people to come out and hide for us. Because we need on a regular basis to simulate a search. So what we're trying to do is say we put a person out in the woods and say pretend you're lost and let the dogs come and find them. And we actually have in our unit a program we call the Dogs Buddies program where these are people who that's all they do. They go out in the woods, they take a book, and they hide for us. And Amy, I think you've got something similar, don't you?
Yeah, it's called our support team for the canine group. And we have several people that they're just hiders, and that's all they do. They come out and hide for us, and we love them.
You know, guys, this time is flying by. We have 8 minutes left, and if you don't mind, I really want to touch on the cadaver dogs, and if we run over an hour, we'll just go a couple of minutes, and the way that the listeners can listen to it, we will no longer be live on the air, but if they listen to the show as a download, they'll hear anything that follows over past the hour. So my next point, guys, is you talked a lot about searching and finding folks. Is there any type of statistic out there? It's a grim statistic, but people that are not found, you know, what is the percentage of people that are lost that are not found alive or just not found at all? Monica?
You know, Robert, I don't know if there is a gentleman, by the way, out of Virginia, University of Virginia, who is actually Bob Koster, who is actually starting to try to get these statistics pulled together. I don't know if we have any national statistics yet. It is a fact in search and rescue, though, that there will be the time that we do not find the person alive, or we don't find them at all. We all have searches that are still weighing on our hearts, the Kyron Horman search up in Portland. We have a little boy named Sammy Belke who went missing in Crater Lake National Park. 2004, we still haven't found him. I know, Amy, you have a woman up in the Lane County area that we keep looking for over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we do have people that we don't find, and we just keep looking until we find them. I mean, you know, that's reality. Sometimes it takes years, but often we ultimately find them. The cadaver dogs become useful then because there comes a point at which you have to admit that the person is no longer alive. So now the question is, you know, a lot of people would say, well, then you just give up. And our answer to that is no, we don't. It's still our obligation to bring them home. Their families need to know what's happened to them. There's so many things that having an actual awareness of the death of the person can matter. For example, you can't get an insurance policy unless you can actually prove that the person is dead. So if a person is missing, head of the household is missing, and the family can't get access to the insurance, that can mean disaster for that family. So we feel our commitment is also to recovering the person even if they're no longer alive. And the cadaver dogs are trained specifically to identify the scent, and sorry if we gross your readers out, of decomposing human tissue, because it's a different scent. It smells different than a live human being. And what we do with the dogs is we teach them that that is a scent that we also want them to find, and they're extremely good at it. They're probably in those situations the best resource incident command can use, because the human eye is no longer going to be very useful.
And I know, Amy, you had mentioned that you started training your dog at very young on this cadaver scent. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know you hit on it right at the beginning of the show.
Sure. Yeah, I got my dog from a kennel who specializes in search and rescue dogs, Vombanak Canine. And she, what the breeder does is she imprints all her puppies, if they're going to go to search and rescue homes or not, on cadaver scent. And because most of her dogs do, but at 3 weeks old, like I said, she gets these little stuffed animals with cadaver scent kind of, with them in a plastic bag, and it kind of just soaks up in the stuffed animals. And then they just let the puppies play with them, and it just kind of gets them used to that scent. And so, and the reason for that is because a lot of dogs, when they start training cadaver at an older age and they don't get imprinted at a young age, they have an aversion to it. They don't like it, and they just kind of shy away from it. So that's the reason for imprinting them. And she was also, started her cadaver training once I got her, about 9 weeks old. You know, we have a jar of the stuff and, have her come up to it and sit and give her a treat. And we just do that for a lot. And then we start hiding it and putting it in different places, and it becomes a really fun game for them. And so that's how they start them off.
My impression of a cadaver search is probably what a lot of people's is you'll see the dog on the boat looking for the drowning victim in the water. Can you explain kind of a little bit of a scenario about a cadaver search? How does that take place, if it's at all different than a regular search and rescue operation?
It is different, Robert. This is Monica. It is different. I mean, the water dog, that is actually, the water dog is simply an extension of the cadaver dog. What we actually, that's an advancement where you teach a dog who understands how to search on land that things can also be under the water, and you also teach them that their search platform can be a boat, which is a big change for the dog. They're not free to run around. In a standard cadaver search, what normally happens is that we have an area that has been narrowed down as the most likely area where this person is deceased. The dogs will go out and will start to just search in the same mechanism that an air scent dog might search, but now what you're doing is you're simply saying to the dog, this is what we're looking for. For example, my dog Mara has a different command for cadavers. I put on Amy's wonderful collar is actually her her signal that we're doing cadaver work. And so it's a different thing. And also she and I work slightly differently. It's a much finer search, because you either have a complete human remains, which is unusual because, again, sorry to gross out your reader, your listeners, but in the wilderness, if a person goes down in the wilderness, the local animals don't respect that body. They think of it as food. So what happens is you often have disarticulated remains where you're going to have bones scattered or other things. And so it's a much more precise thing. I find that the difference between Mara can pick up a human scent at anywhere between 300 feet to a quarter of a mile. In land cadavers, she has to be closer, much closer than that, in order to pick it up, because it's a finer scent. So it's a different system. We also have more time, obviously. Once we identify, we don't have the pressure. We don't have the urgency that the person is still likely alive. You have more time to plot it. You have more time to think about it than you really do with an air scent, with a search where you have every reason to believe the person is alive. And let me stress on that, by the way. We don't assume that anybody's dead for well over a month, because we've had situations. The woman in, where was she, Nevada, I guess it was, who was alive for, 7 weeks? We assume they're alive for a very, very long time, but there comes a time at which you have to say, okay, let's see what we can do about helping the family.
So with that, you had mentioned the little boy in Crater Lake since 2004. Obviously,
yeah.
that's that's 7 years from now.
Yeah.
Unless it's a kidnapping situation, mm-hmm. obviously the little kid can't be, you know, obviously out there for any amount of time whatsoever. So how does it happen then? You know, you guys are deployed for missing people, and it's been much longer. When is that determination made? Okay, we're no longer searching for a live person. We're now going to employ the cadaver dogs. How does it switch gears, I guess, is what my question is.
This is Monica. That's really a decision that is made by our incident commanders, our search managers. Most times, for them to switch a search over to recovery mode, they have actually had discussions with medical people. You know, they'll describe the situation, they'll describe the person, they'll say, what are the odds this person is still alive? We'll get a lot of information from things like Bob Koster's research on, you know, how long can people survive out there. So it's really their decision as to when they think that is the time to do that. Something like Sammy, I mean, obviously at this point we're dealing with a recovery. Unless it's a kidnapping situation, he's not alive anymore. But, you know, his mother wants to know where he is. So do we.
And if I could just interject there just for a second, a lot of times we're dealing with, you know, I don't think people understand the area. You know, you think about, oh, well, you know, he's around Crater Lake, and that's not a very, Crater Lake, that's not a very big place. But it is huge. I mean,
yes.
Literally, you could be within a quarter of a mile, which is just to the highway from my house.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a huge search area, that quarter of a mile,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and as a matter of fact, at Crater Lake, there have been, that I know of, there have been 6 missions up there to search for Sammy, because the area that he went missing in is probably 3 or 4 miles by 3 or 4 miles. That is huge. And so, you know, it is hard to figure out where he may have gone. And what you do is you just, you know, you do it systematically. You set up systems, you take your best information as to where the person is likely to be, you search that area. If they're not found in that area, you rethink it. You say, okay, our first thoughts were wrong. Where should we search now? But it's a very intensive thing, especially something like that one, because, yes, Crater Lake is an enormous area.
Right, right. Okay, ladies, we are out of time. I definitely want to make sure that we can get some contact information from you. Are you guys on Facebook or Twitter? I know Amy is, but how can we send over some questions if people have them, both Monica and Amy?
Amy, go for it.
Yeah, you can just – I'm on Facebook. Even my company, Mountain Dog Gear, is on there. You can look us up on Facebook and ask any questions you may have there, and I'll do my best to answer. There's also a lot of other search volunteers that are on there as well, and we're kind of all connected, so you can we have a lot of knowledge to pull from to answer any questions you may have.
Right.
And I think there will be a lot of questions. And remember, guys, this show airs forever, so you guys might get a question 6 months or a year from now. So be prepared for some of that. And I know with Amy's website, Mountain Dog Gear, is that correct?
Yes.
MountainDogGear.com. That's got a great place to go for a contact page and things like that. Monica, anything else you would like to add to close today?
I think, first of all, let me put in a plug, because Amy is being a little bit modest about her company. If you want working dog gear, she right now is one of the best places to go. She customizes. She does awesome stuff, and we're sending people her way all the time. So I want to put in a plug for her, because she's already done a couple of things for me that my dog just thinks rock. And by the way, Amy, as we come up, Dingle's going to need some stuff soon. So,
okay, let me know.
But I guess the other thing is just to say to your listeners, thank you for listening to us. You know, we want to encourage people, if you think you have the time, and by the way, time means often close to 1,000 hours a year of training and time. If you think you have the time to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, go out and search for somebody, and you have a dog who is a good dog, and as Michelle mentions, young enough that they'll have a working career. It takes about 2 years to train a search and rescue dog up to where they can actually go out and do missions. Please help us. And if you can't help us that way, there's a lot of other things you can do for your local search and rescue group. Offer to volunteer for them. Make some, you know, make them chocolate chip cookies. You know, on a mission, when you come back in and there's a cookie there, wow, you know, we're just like the dogs. You know, it means something to us. You know, help them. Help people understand if they're going in the wilderness how to be safe. And, you know, we thank you guys, too, for what you're doing to help get the message out.
Thank you very much. That's Monica McFadden. She is a canine handler with the Josephine County Sheriff's Search and Rescue Office in Oregon, which is right down near Grants Pass. So she's kind of in the southern area of Oregon, and we have Amy. Amy, I'm not going to butcher your name again. Please tell us your last name and any last remark you would like to add.
Okay, my last name is Hisaoka, and yeah, I really want to thank you again for having us on the show, and like you mentioned, if anybody has any questions, we are very open to answering them and open to people more interested in wanting to get involved. You know, just check it out, see what it's all about, and we'll help you out. But yeah, thanks for having us on, and yeah, we really enjoyed this time.
Well, thank you guys very much. Michelle, would you like to add anything before we close?
No, I just, you know, from this point forward, any inquiries on Denver Dog Works are being forwarded on to Monica and Amy regarding search and rescue. You guys are very, very much appreciated in our industry as to educating the public about search and rescue.
Thank you guys
for having us.
No problem at all. Thank you guys so much, and I'll make sure I send over a link to this show after I get it all posted, and if we have to do any editing out. I don't think we did. We didn't have any call drops or anything, so it sounds to be like it'll be good. So I'll definitely shoot that over to Amy, then you can forward it on to Monica, if you will. We'll
okay.
Keep in touch for sure. I'll definitely send over some questions, and you know, if the point arises where we need to have you guys on again, we'll be the first to call, okay?
Okay,
well,
thank you very much.
Thank you. And this is Robert Forto on behalf of our guests and our co-host Michelle Forto at Denver Dog Works. This is Dog Works Radio. We'll see you guys on Sunday. We have a graphic artist that does artwork for your pets, and that will be an interesting show to try to describe artwork on the radio. We've never done that before, but we're going to give it a shot. So until then, this is Dog Works Radio. Never forget your dreams. See you next time. Goodbye.